This is Interviews with Technical People with John Robertson
and James Haview,
a podcast where we interview technical people in STEM fields
to discuss the past, present, and future from their perspective.
And today we're joined by Jeff Behari. Jeff is the curator of the Electrotherapy Museum, where he is a historian for medical, scientific, and electrical fields. Jeff also does R&D work for the RGF Environmental Group. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Hi, James. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you.
Before we fully get started, we just wanted to take a moment to tell the story of how we even met in the first place. And I think that'd be a fun place to start. And James, I know you like telling the story.
Yeah, as I remember, in college, there was a lab in our physics department that did lightning research. And with that being a fairly popular field, they did a bunch of documentary interviews and stuff. And Jeff was involved in a lot of those shoots because he had a lot of electrical discharge machines. And he also did a public lecture in our department that I remember. And we got talking to him one day and we're like, you have a museum that you run. And we took about a dozen and a half of our classmates down to your turn of the century electrotherapy museum that you ran in your house at the time. And, spent the day and had lunch with you. And it was a really great time. And we really enjoyed that.
It was a big moment for us. One of my favorite parts is we took two 12 or 15 passenger vans, just loaded them up and, just completely raided your house, Jeff, and came with this huge number of people. And you were an incredible host.
I distinctly remember it because at one point, because I had things scattered about the house, I remember showing, Crookes and Geisler tubes in a spare bedroom that I had been sleeping in. And I remember everyone piled on the bed as I'm lighting up these tubes.
Yeah, I remember that. And you really turn the lights off and we're all piled on your bed.
And I remember my bulldog at the time, Mela, who has lived up until this year. She finally passed, but 13 years, she was getting lots of attention from everyone.
There was always somebody to pet the dog.
Yeah.
And so with that kind of introduction for how we met, Jeff, what I think a good place to start would be, why don't you just tell us in your own words, what is it that you do?
That's a good question sometimes. I was a machinist for 25 years, and part of that was my dad got me interested in it. He always had a workshop at home, and we started collecting machines like lathes and milling machines and like old time manufacturing equipment. And he never actually used any of it, which was funny because he had all this stuff, but I rarely saw him build anything. And once in a while he'd be tinkering outside. And so I took up this equipment, started learning how to use it, and eventually got jobs in machine shops. And
did you start when you were very young? About how old?
Probably around 16 or so. Oh,
okay.
So not. I mean, I was always building stuff, but as far as metalworking, that came kind of later on. But we had my grandfather. You know, I come from Pittsburgh originally, and my grandfather built us a foundry, and so my dad and I started casting metal together at home, and it was about the time that Mel Fisher was doing was uncovering a lot of shipwrecks like the Atosha off the coast of the Keys. And one of the things he had uncovered was an astrolabe, which was an old like piece of navigation equipment kind of from the 1500s. But it was a big deal because the things were really rare. And my dad had this idea of writing Mel and trying to get like blueprints of this. And it was one of our first projects together was we cast like five or six of these astrolabe, like pretty accurate replicas in our backyard in Florida, 90 degree summer, wearing like 10 shirts and a face shield in front of a 1800 degree furnace. And
did they work? Did you try them out?
No, I mean, actually, it's very complicated how to actually use one. I mean, you basically aim them at either the sun or the stars, and you have to calculate angles and depending on times of the year. And many people got lost trying to navigate with them. I think Columbus, most famously, we know where he ended up. So yeah, it was just a cool project, but it got me exposed at a young age to like, hey, this is cool. This kind of old technology and who casts metal in their backyard? Nobody really.
Cool. I think you're the only one I know. So where did you go from there?
So it was also about that time that I started the museum, and the museum was really just a hobby, and it came out of nowhere because we were very randomly talking about opening a coffee shop, and so my dad and I were both
you're still pretty young.
This was 16, 17.
Yeah.
Wasn't sure what to do after high school. So I got into the culinary arts, and we were going to open a coffee shop at one point. And we decided we were going to decorate the coffee shop with coffee related antiques. So I kept buying like coffee grinders, espresso machines, that sort of thing. But I would always see these weird gadgets in the antique shows, and no one really explained what they were. They were just labeled like quackery. But they were all cool looking. I mean, like vaguely scientific, vaguely Victorian, like black boxes lined with velvet with blown glass tubes and some kind of electrical workings with them. And finally, one day I bought one just for the hell of it to see what this thing was. And I plugged it in, and the TV started going across the room. And I said, okay, I better unplug the TV before something goes wrong. And I went to unplug the TV, and it wasn't even plugged in. And really? So at that time, I kind of vaguely knew that there was a guy, Tesla, that worked with wireless energy and that. But it was very early on before he became popular and even on the internet. And so I kind of had an idea that this might be some of that technology, but I wasn't 100% certain.
So it sounds like what you knew was somehow there was this thing was emitting energy that was interacting with your television, and that's about it.
That's about it. And at the time, I knew an electrical engineer who was in his 80s, and he lived down the road, and he saw this thing, and he actually recognized the type of machine from when he went to college in Tulsa, and it was called a diathermy machine. And I noticed when I plugged this thing in, there were like these pads, and if you'd stuck your hand in between them, it got really hot. And so it was basically an RF heating device that was used medically to treat like inflammation for like rehabilitation. And this old man, Quinn, he was saying, you know, we had one of these in school, but there was a big sign. No one was allowed to plug it in. Nobody knew what it did. And so here I was, probably 60 years later, exposing him to one of these machines, plugging it in. I noticed if you waved like a fluorescent light near it, it would light up.
And how old was this machine?
This machine was from like the late teens, early 20s.
Okay.
So that kind of got me interested in this sort of thing. And when the next antique show, there was a guy actually demonstrating another one of these quackery devices. And he had the thing plugged in, and there was a glass electrode in the end that was glowing purple. And when he reached his hand up to the electrode, sparks were jumping to his hand, like little 1-inch sparks. I instantly had to have it. I mean, this was the weirdest thing I've ever seen. And so I think he wanted like $35 or something for this. And I bought it and brought it home. And I told him that he's like, oh, yeah, I've seen many of these things over the years. And I said, I'll buy every one you find if you can sell it for this kind of $30-$40 range and still make some money off of it. And I ended up buying like probably 50 of them over the next couple of years. And then I know it went to the internet at the time. There wasn't really any information on any of this history. And so I kind of thought, okay, I'm going to start a website and maybe do something different.
Was this like the late 90s, that time frame when the internet was just beginning?
It was. I started around 96 with this website, and it was just something fun. And what I didn't expect is within a few years, because you were able to track web traffic, by the early 2000s, I was getting around 7 million hits a year, which it's kind of a
obscure
term, but I never guessed that people would actually be interested in this stuff. And so within 10 years, I was searching, combing the planet, trying to find stuff. And I had over 500 machines at one point.
And of course, but by this point, it had branched off to a lot more than just that first device that you had, right? It's a whole different array of technologies. Is that true?
Right, right. I mean, it started off with just an interest in this general kind of quackery era, because it was kind of interesting that there were so many medical devices sold that the general belief was they were all useless. But it was kind of like selling snake oil at the time. But the more I was looking into it from a critical point of view, I realized some of the stuff had some legitimate technology behind it. Some of it was just pure marketing nonsense based on people's lack of knowledge in the subjects of electricity. And so then I noticed some of the machines looked very legitimately medical, and they were like surgical machines and this sort of thing, early X-ray machines. So yeah, it branched off into a way of kind of trying to learn the history, trying to separate fact and fiction. And what I found out was the reason there was not much history on this topic was because of the quackery aspect. Much of this history was confiscated and destroyed over the years on purpose to try and protect people. And
when did that happen?
This was heavy in the 30s and 40s.
Okay.
And so what happened as a result, and you can imagine this, people remembered these devices. Some people used them and had some benefits. Sometimes it was placebo, sometimes it was real. And all of a sudden, they all started disappearing and warnings put out. And then it was quiet all of a sudden. There was nothing left. And people kind of, they remembered all of these devices. But as far as formal history, like books about them were even burned at one point. And it's, which is strange. It's something you think about happening in other countries, but not in the States. And it was all in an effort just to protect people. But, you know, when you destroy history, no one really learns from it. It would have been a much better approach to just educate people about it and go from there.
Was the argument that they were harmful to people or just not helpful and kind of a scam? What was the reason?
It went both ways. And most of the time, there were a lot of these devices sold in, like the smaller devices were sold in catalogs, especially for treating conditions that people might be embarrassed to go to their doctors for. So at that time, anything kind of questionable was sold that way, and people bought them. And so as a way of cutting down on the quackery, they were confiscated as like mail fraud by the FDA and AMA and other organizations. So, I mean, they were trying to protect people. But the unfortunate thing is also that a lot of the devices started off as, for example, as surgical machines or something authentic, but they were marketed by people as cure-alls. And then at that point, it was also fraud. So they were taken off the market because of how they were being sold. And a lot of times the inventors had no intentions of these things being sold the way they were.
That's one thing I remember when we visited your place was there were so many of these machines that we didn't know these ever existed. The concept was there and there was all these cure-alls, and you'd gotten to the point where I think every decoration in your house was some sort of, you know, old machine like this with all these concepts that we'd never heard of before.
It was. And the interesting part about the history, and that's why it's a shame that it's always a shame to destroy history in some way, because the stories were fascinating with the people involved. And a lot of times, even the most useless of medical devices ended up being useful later on because of they were trying to avoid patent infringements of each other and this sort of thing. So some of the more useless devices were like shocking. They had these boxes that you would get electric shocks from, almost like a modern TENS machine, where if you go for physical therapy and they put the pads on your back, this kind of thing, but much cruder. Whether they had medical benefit is somewhat questionable, but a lot of times the technology was used later on, for example, in radio coils or in various circuits in the 20s, where they like telephone type of circuits. a lot of the concepts of how the apparatus worked from a mechanical perspective or from an electrical perspective ended up being useful later on. And all of these, like early Tesla coils and things, you could, I mean, if you modified one, you could send radio signals to someone. You could transmit wireless messages. So even if it was a worthless quack device, it still had a practical use from physics.
I also find it interesting that I'm sure some people were just scared off by this idea of, you know, whatever, irradiating somebody for medical purposes. But then I also think that there's some modern medical tools, like, for example, radiation treatment for cancers that are completely legitimate techniques, but they don't sound that different at first glance, right? You're just zapping someone with this high power beam. But yet some of these have proven to be very useful.
Exactly. And there's I'm amazed that the medical profession today really doesn't know its own history. And I've had multiple companies over the years contact me for patent infringements, lawsuits, that sort of thing, where they were trying to argue who had priority on a topic. And because I had a museum, they knew I might have some insight on that. And most of the time, the concepts were developed 80 years ago, and they were just unaware of their own industry. Because in the medical field, anything sort of older than 5 or 10 years is considered obsolete because of the advances that are happening there. But from the machinery, from the mechanics of the machines involved, not much has changed over the years. And in the X-ray field, it's really interesting that they've gone full circle. The original style of X-ray machine was a portable high-frequency set developed. Kinraid was one of the first people to develop it in the 1890s. And now, universally, almost all X-ray machines use the same principle. And so they went from, in the 80s, being machines that weighed 500 pounds with tons of iron and steel, back to pulse transformers operating high-frequency tubes. And it's completely gone full spectrum now.
Interesting. I think, go ahead, James.
I was saying, I do remember some stuff that didn't come full circle, because I thought, didn't you have some stuff where there was a lot of mercury in some machines? And
wasn't that
a cure-all as well? And you'd have some around and you're like, we're just not going to talk about, we're not going to touch this much, but it's here.
Wait, there are so many things, like radium water was a kick for a while. And so I have radium water purifiers and mercury, like some of the early UV lamps had as much as 3 to 4 pounds of mercury in a bulb. And those bulbs were operating around 1100 degrees. And if you touched the bulb, we had fingerprints on them. They had a tendency of cracking while they were operating. So you could imagine turning on this bulb. They produced a ton of radiation. But then on top of that, having them fail and having, you know, a kilogram of volatilized mercury in the house or office or wherever it was. So a lot of them did have various hazards present. Most of the machines had exposed high voltage parts and like lethal shock hazards. And in the X-ray field, it was actually kind of interesting. I met one of the grandkids of the pioneers who he developed the first shockproof X-ray, but it wasn't until 23 years after the invention of the X-ray that they decided to make the machine safe. And the only reason they did was because this dental manufacturer made a machine and the dentist got electrocuted from it because there was exposed 70,000 volt wires. And his machine was no different than any others on the market at the time. But he was so affected by it, he set off to develop a safe machine. Because you can imagine inventing something and knowing that someone died because of it. And even though there was nothing that different about his machine and other people's, they just didn't put the logical sense together. Okay, let's make it safe for everyone to work around.
Well, let's not be exposed to, you know, expose 70,000 volt, you know, parts. That's
a lot of volts.
Yeah. And it took a long time even in the industry for lead shielding to show up. I mean, there for a good 15 years, there were exposed X-ray tubes out in the open, even 20, 25 years. It took a long time before the radiation aspect and the operators were shielded.
Is that because they didn't know the effects, or it just wasn't economically feasible? Or
no, it's a great question. They knew the dangers of X-rays the first year of the discovery. And as the history goes, it was actually Edison's assistant at the time, Thomas Daly. And it was during the great race of Edison and Tesla constantly arguing with each other and trying to outdo each other. They were both developing, trying to develop a new style of lamp around 1896. And Tesla was developing these phosphorescent button bulbs where he put carborundum, which is basically what grinding wheels are made out of today, in a very high vacuum and running it with a single wire. And what would happen is it was essentially an X-ray tube where the focus of the X-rays was on this carbon button. And when the X-rays focused on the button, it became incandescent and produced light. In Edison's version of the bulb, he just took an X-ray tube and coated the inside with a phosphor, much like a fluorescent lamp. And his assistant was searching for the brightest phosphor to make the most efficient lamp. And he ended up finding that calcium tungstate was the brightest material. Yet he began developing problems. He had his fingers amputated and finally his hand after a while. And he died of X-rays. He died. And this was all within the first year of the discovery. There was a dentist, William Rollins, who early on, he was arguing with everyone. And it was a guy that nobody liked. He was a dentist developing his own equipment. And because he was kind of in his 80s and a little bit crotchety, and he was known for, in the public journals, kind of like cutting people down if they had views different than his. But this guy was on par for almost everything. He had actually put X-ray tubes inside of a box lined with lead or with lead white paint. He enclosed the wires in so that there were no shock hazards present. There were people working early on, but there were a lot of people then arguing, because Tesla was one who he tried to say that the X-rays weren't dangerous. And he had noticed if he put an aluminum screen around the bulbs or in between the bulb and the patient, let's say, that there was less chance of getting an X-ray burn. And what he was doing was cutting out the scattered rays with these grounded screens. And there were people like Kinraid, who was working with electrical discharges independently of developing X-rays, and Kinraid noticed that he was getting burns from the sparks even when there were no tubes attached. And it was nitric burns that he was getting because of the amount of ozone and nitric compounds these coils were producing in the air in his lab. So there were a lot of people still kind of arguing that X-rays weren't dangerous, even though they clearly were. And to make things even more complicated, a lot of the pioneers were being very casual with rays. Instead of developing photographic plates, they were using the fluoroscope, which is basically like a fluorescent paint on a piece of cardboard inside of a box that you could look into and see live X-rays. The fluorescent paint would glow green color, and you could hold it up to someone standing in front of an X-ray tube and see a live view of their skeleton.
Instead of
an image, they were looking at live X-rays. And the problem is, when you're holding this thing in front of someone, you're getting X-ray too the whole time. Right. And so instead of like a 15-second exposure to make a plate, they would stand there for 2 or 3 minutes because it was easier and it didn't have chemicals involved, and they could just diagnose someone by X-rays live. And what was happening, the patients were okay in the end. I mean, they were getting an excess of radiation, but the doctors were finding that they were developing skin cancers. There were multiple pioneers that were having fingers amputated, and they were so enamored by the invention that they were checking into different hospitals under false names to have the surgeries done, because they thought if they exposed that they were getting harmed by the rays, they would give the industry a bad name. And it wasn't until the late teens that finally someone got fed up with it, and he was started exposing all of the X-ray pioneers that had massive injuries. And were many, many people had died early on. Many of the developers of X-ray tubes died within a few years of the discovery, because they were testing all the tubes personally on their own hands while they were evacuating them, taking the air out, making sure the levels were correct inside the tubes. So it was a weird combination of people not wanting to face the facts of the dangers because they were so enamored with the fact that, hey, we can see the invisible and do so much with this invention.
Hey Jeff, there's a curious question I have. How much has the generation of X-rays been modernized since, you know, the X-ray tubes came out? Is it still the same mechanism that we use today? What's the progression there?
There's very little progression, actually. The first tubes were what they called cold cathode. And so it was just a very high voltage across two electrodes in a tube. And as you accelerated the electrons in the tube, they would hit the target and create X-rays. It was just high voltage and two electrodes, typically with a platinum or a tungsten target. And then in 1915, there was a guy, Coolidge, who he was working with filaments, and he was the first person to make tungsten malleable. And he had developed the hot cathode tube, where basically you could heat a filament inside of the tube, and the vacuum would become more stable. You could run the tubes at a much higher vacuum. The problem with the cold cathode tubes were that the vacuum was always changing. So in addition to the basic knowledge a physician would have to have of how to use his machine, he would have to manipulate his machines to accommodate how the tubes were changing as he was operating them. Because the vacuums would actually change mid-exposure sometimes, and the tubes would stop producing X-rays or produce weaker X-rays. And the fascinating thing about the design of the tubes, they actually made the tubes where you could regulate the vacuum inside of them. So it's a pretty in-depth topic of how the early tubes were developed. This man Coolidge was able to make a tube that was much more stable, much more easy to operate. He could control the current going through the filament and have a much simpler apparatus on the generating side. And that basic tube is still used today. There's very, very little developments at all.
Really?
As far as anything modern, really. The only difference in CAT scan machines and MRIs, they've made because of the high currents involved, they've made the electrodes able to be rotated at high speeds inside of the tubes. And that's just so they could put more current through the tubes without having things disintegrate and break down inside the vacuums.
Interesting. But the fundamental physics is still the same.
Yes. And if you go to especially like a dental office today and get X-rays, the machine is no different than one from 1915. The biggest advance has been digital imaging. Mm-hmm. So, which is incredible. Now you can just take it's like taking a raw image on a digital camera and being able to manipulate it. And so you've cut down the exposure massively for the patient side of things.
So you're just able to read the image differently, but you're still
producing
the rays the same as you ever did.
Exactly. So you're able to, and the nice thing about the modern imaging is it's one image and you can manipulate it and change all the contrast. You don't need chemicals. You don't need any of the developers. And exposure time is cut way down, maybe 200th of a second now compared to even like a 20th of a second of the past for films.
I say in 20 years, the X-rays at my dentist office are so much better than they used to be.
You know, yes, it's much simpler now.
Yeah, it's so quick. It's the digital imagery, you know, but still the same X-rays.
It's still the same. And it's amazing now how simple and how inexpensive the machines have become. And I know years ago I was the cool thing about the early technology, they were developing in the teens and 20s, they had this great idea that, well, why are we making so many machines for a doctor's office? You could have an X-ray machine, a surgical machine, all your diagnostic machines, all built into one because the electrical circuits are really similar in all of those. And so the idea was, well, why have 10 machines if you could make one for $200 and not need anything else in your office? And I guess in the mid 2000s, I had the idea that it would be a great thing to bring back for like third world countries, because you could essentially build this stuff really cheap. And since then, the article that I did, it was with Ant Mini, which was a well-known radiological journal. Now in China, they're making units, and I've seen on eBay complete X-ray machines for like $500.
Wow!
And it's pretty amazing, considering in the past it might have been 20 or 30,000 minimum for one.
So, speaking of some of these developments, Jeff, I think one thing that'd be interesting to talk about. So, not only have you done research on these devices, but you've personally constructed and replicated a lot of these old devices. I'm sure our audience would love to hear some stories about some that have stood out to you as far as interesting physics or relevance for today. Are there any that stand out to you that you'd want to share?
Well, definitely. Actually, getting back to how we met, it was about the time, it was in the mid-2000s that there was one X-ray pioneer I was very interested in, because he was photographing electricity. And he was making art out of high voltage, and I saw a few of the pictures, and they were incredible. And I had the idea that, wow, if I could, he lived in Boston, in a town, Jamaica Plain. And I had this idea that, well, if I could find any of these photos, maybe rummage around shops up there, you know, it would be a fantastic piece of history, because it's one topic you don't see much history on. And as it turns out, I ended up finding this man's home, and it was a 25-room mansion in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. And the owner let me in, let me explore, and there I found hidden rooms under the house of this man. And
the owner didn't know about?
The owner vaguely knew there was something there, but there was no electricity in any of these rooms, so he didn't explore them at all. And it was strange, because it was in the basement, what looked like a small closet door. And as you walked in the closet, the room circled around these passages, basically under the house. And the house was built on top of rock. And as the story originally went, this man, Thomas Kinraid, he used dynamite to explode the foundation of his house to be able to build rooms underneath it. So the walls are almost cave-like when you're walking in these rooms. And I read about, from one of the X-ray pioneers' books, Frederick Strong, he wrote a book, High Frequency Currents, in 1908. And he described being inspired by X-rays by this man, Kinraid. And he was in his house, and at a time when they were lucky to photograph just the bones of the human hand, this man was doing the entire human skeleton live in his lab. And I found a lot of the original equipment there, and I have it on display now. The owner gave it all to me. He said, if I found any of this stuff, I wouldn't have known what it was. I'd have probably thrown it out. But in addition to that, there were hundreds and hundreds of glass plate photos of electrical discharges. And when I got these photos, they were moldy. They were mildewing. I mean, the floors were dirt in these rooms, and it was winter. There was frost. They smelled bad. These photos, they were wrapped in kind of manila envelopes at the time.
I grew up in an old farmhouse in New England, and the basement is not a good place for stuff like that. So,
there were leaves on the floor. I mean, it was crazy. I mean, it was really cool in a way. But I mean, even the boxes, the crates that these photos were in were just disintegrating from time. I mean, they were there 120 years. And so I got all the stuff home. I ended up setting them up in a spare bathroom with a lot of ozone lamps just to try and kill all of the mold and mildew that was involved at the time. But the strange thing, in looking at the photos, and at the time, I had done a lot of research in the Tesla coils, and I was actually one of the family historians for the Tesla family because of the research I was doing. And the photographs, the electricity represented was really strange, and it didn't look like anything I ever saw from any of the machines. And when I reached out to a lot of physicists, they were saying, maybe it's just the photographic exposure at the time. There were glass plates. They had a very slow speed. It probably wasn't representative of what the people were seeing with the apparatus.
Well, real quick, how was he taking the photos of the electricity?
So he had these, they were kind of a flat spiral version of a Tesla coil that, so you imagine this electrical coil that was producing these sparks just in the air from like a copper ball. So this coil had a center terminal going up. There was a 2 to 6 inch copper ball placed in the terminal of the coil. And when you operated it, sparks would dart out from the ball in all directions. And what he would do is take a photographic plate, balance it on top of the coil, and turn the coil on just for a split second in the dark. And what would happen is the light from the sparks would expose the photograph. He would develop it, and then you'd have an image of whatever he was seeing. And so for years, I was trying to decipher what he was doing because the sparks had a very unique appearance. They were very fractal in appearance. They were a lot like tree branches, but unlike the typical like sparks from like a modern Tesla coil that you see, they had a very curious geometry about them. And no one really could explain what they were. Some people went as far as even saying that they were faked photos. And I'm like, no, there's hundreds of them. It's absurd. They're on glass. The guide never even published this stuff. So I started replicating his machines based on his patents and what fragments of apparatus I found in his lab. And I was able to replicate the same sparks in the air that I was seeing in these photos. And at the time, I was contacted about doing a lightning documentary by Jägermeister of all organizations in Holland. And they were doing some kind of documentary. They were very quiet about what the full picture was of this video they were making. But I said, sure, you can come to my home. And as it turned out, it was kind of a mockumentary where a young man was purposely trying to get struck by lightning. And in the documentary, they had visited Florida Tech and interviewed with the Joe Dwyer. And so in the documentary, I saw, oh, wow, these lightning experts, I didn't know about them. And so I reached out to Joe and Florida Tech. And within days, he and Ninju and Hamid Razul came to my house because I mentioned I had these strange photographs of electricity and I wanted some explanation for. And that's how I met.
And I just want to pause real quick because some people might not know the name Joe Dwyer, but we all do because he was a Florida Tech professor who was one of the foremost experts on lightning in the world. He discovered all sorts of things about lightning fairly recently that for centuries we hadn't known.
When we were in college, they sometimes referred to him as like the modern day Ben Franklin or something. He was just one of our college professors.
Yeah, and we should get him on the show one of these days. But just he was a local just really interesting guy for the research that he did. So that connection's growing here. So
he was, as far as I know, he was the first person to actually prove that lightning made X-rays.
Yep,
and He came to the house. It was literally like 3 days later. They all drove down and they spent hours at the house. And Joe, I remember he was looking at the glass plates. And one of the things I noticed was in the images, what appeared to be positive and negative electricity united. And I'm like, well, shouldn't they cancel each other out? I mean, why is this happening? And I've seen it in the air with the coils I was replicating. And Joe took one look at it and he said, yeah, these are the events you see that we've theorized in upper atmospheric lightning on paper, but we've never actually seen photographic evidence of it. So he said, what Kinraid was doing and what I was doing was pretty unique all of a sudden.
So what do we mean by positive and negative electricity? Because in my mind, I just think electricity is the flow of electrons across a voltage.
So with as these electrical discharges are forming, they can have a polarity. And so how they form in the air is very different just from a photographic or from an appearance sake. The positive electricity darts out in these fractals that look almost like ferns or snowflake patterns in the air. And the negative electricity actually is forming from the opposite direction, from the outside air inward, in what looks like peacock feathers. to best describe it. And what I noticed with these machines is that in the normal air and normal humidities, the discharge would always tend to be positive, even though the coil apparatus was a Tesla coil. It was producing like an oscillating type of discharge, which should be AC current in the air, not DC. But because of the particulars of this coil and the geometry of it and the low powers used and some of the adjustment apparatus involved, the discharge appears as a static electricity coming off of it. But the unique thing, what we're seeing in the air here is actual, not the spark, but spark leaders. So we're seeing the events that lead up to a lightning strike in the air, and without the actual lightning happening. And it's stuff that happens like milliseconds before sparks are formed. And it's a kind of a unique situation, because in the lab, it's Kinraid was doing it. He was off to himself. There were a few other people in the late 1800s that were, they were charging, like using static charges on glass and sprinkling dust on the plates and seeing some of these kind of weird images. But in the air with this apparatus, to give you an example, I have a coil that with 15 watts of input power from the wall, I'm stepping it up to a high voltage, discharging it through this coil. I'm seeing these fractals that are 12 inches long in all directions and over a half inch thick. And this is something that I'll have to send some pictures along so anyone listening can actually appreciate it. But it's very interesting to see in the air. And by minute adjustments of this apparatus, you're able to see positive forms flying out, darting out in all directions. You can stick your hand in them. You can feel them. Sometimes you can adjust the machine to make what looks like Northern Lights, what looks like St. Elmo's fire. And other times you get these just pure spark leaders forming in the air.
So you mentioned the spark leaders, kind of these electrical effects that can sometimes be precursors to lightning strikes, for example.
Right. Right.
So would that be like these effects appearing near, I guess, what would be the cathode, the positive end electrode, like prior to a full arc? Is that what that is?
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's like, even with, I have in the museum, for example, I have one of the largest static machines that was made historically. It's about a 600 pound machine, 24 rotating plates. You can get 16 inch like lightning-like discharges at the terminals, but you don't actually see any of these leader events happening. You just see the sparks. You might see a slight purple glow around the electrodes, but predominantly you see sparks coming out of the terminals. And with this other apparatus, you're not seeing the spark. You're seeing all of the precursors without the spark actually happening. And that's what it makes it interesting. And the discharges look very much like sprite lightning, if you've seen any of the recent photos that people have done. The last few years, there's started to be some showing up online, really cool. But you have one direction where you have this very distinct fractal moving upward with a positive appearance. And in the other direction, you have a negative appearance where it's a shorter kind of feathery looking discharge.
And so Joe Dwyer took a look at this and said, aha, I know.
Joe knew exactly what it was, and I had asked Joe specifically. I said, do you want to do anything with this? Because I can generate all of this stuff, but I can't explain all the physics behind why I'm able to do it. And I've since figured out a lot of it. And he was like, no, this is really cool. I can't explain it either, and I don't want to. He said, it's much more fun to just send lots of students to your house and have them see something in someone's backyard that we can't quite explain. And now, years later, it's kind of, I'm revisiting the subject, and it's making sense with the work, kind of work I do.
Have scientists been able to explain it yet, or is it still just a really cool phenomenon?
It's part of it is the what's happening with the electrical apparatus, and I was taking a stab because I was a machinist for years. I was able to do some interesting mechanical work. And that's one thing, like in all of the early electrical machines from Tesla's time, from Franklin's time, everything was as much mechanical as it was electrical, because everything was based on material science at that time. It's very clear when there's a capacitor how it's made. I mean, there's plates of mica, glass, whatever, copper plates, aluminum plates. You can really see how things are made. So for this discharge apparatus, I've actually had something the equivalent of a spark plug in a car, but adjustable to millionths of an inch. And by adjusting the voltage on a, say, a 4,000 or 5,000 volt circuit by the equivalent of like fractions of a volt, I was able to see these things in the air. And so I don't know from the physics perspective why at, say, this circuit at 3,500.01 volts, you can see these positive phenomena appearing and so clearly versus the next voltage. But it's all the best I can explain is whatever chaos is happening in the air at the time, humidity and dust particles and that sort of thing. And this apparatus, because of how the sparks form in the air, they're very reactive to everything around them. So if you're seeing like a positive discharge darting out from this terminal, you reach your hand up against or in the direction of it, a negative one might form just because you're inducing this in the air just with your body.
I had a question. We probably could have talked about this earlier, but I just came up with it. But you know, you're doing all these things with these crazy electrical currents. Have you ever got hurt by the currents you're creating or X-rays or anything like that? With all these machines, like, I feel like you've had to have gotten hurt somehow, sometime.
I've done stuff on stage. My first gig was in New York, and I had 500,000 volts going through my body on stage. On the X-ray side of things, that's something that only time will tell. Joe was worried at one point. He said, you know, probably every spark you've created in your lab has exposed you to X-rays. And he was the only person in the country that would know that because of the research he's done. So that's kind of something new. On the electrical side, I'm very careful. I had the misfortune of receiving almost a lethal shock when I was 20 from one of the machines, from a switch failing. I made the mistake of making some adjustments on a machine with the switch turned off, but it was still plugged in, and the switch had failed at the moment I was holding the terminals and suddenly was energized. And in that moment, I didn't know if I would be alive or drop dead in 10 minutes because your heart gets thrown into such a state of disarray. I mean, every muscle in your chest contracts at that time. You start dripping sweat. I mean, you can survive the shock and then drop dead 10 minutes later.
That sounds terrifying.
So it was, but it was a great lesson in that I've been pretty careful the rest of my life, not, you know, just to take basic precautions in the hand.
Okay, so you've learned to be pretty careful with stuff now.
Yeah, and I've also learned to stage work with it. Like any of us that have done work with, especially voltages exceed a million, you learn how to interact with it. You know the physiological effects of it. And with the electrotherapy side of things, I also learned it. I mean, you can, there are many things to look at from different perspectives with these type of voltages. And people say, oh, there's a skin effect that doesn't affect, it's only on the outside of your body. No, your body is not a piece of metal. It's made of insulators. It's made of conductors and semiconductors inside. So there's always heating effects in the body. You always have to be cognizant of whether you're going to be doing internal damage with any of these kind of experiments.
When I think of millions of volts, I mean, I'm just thinking of at that many volts, can't you just get arcs through, you know, thin air at those voltages? I mean, it just sounds extraordinarily so remarkable, but also dangerous. Is that
true? Yeah. The largest coil I made 12-foot arcs from the terminal.
Oh my goodness.
Obviously, to interact with that in any way, you have to take every precaution or you'll just be cooked.
This sounds like a silly question. I mean, remember, I'm a physicist, so I'm like in awe of what you do. How do you, in your house, produce that many volts?
Well, in this case, it was a coil I built for actually a former VIP of OSHA who's a good friend of mine, John Griswatch, and he's attempting to open a Tesla museum in the Las Vegas area. And so I've built a lot of replicas for him of different machines, like accurate replicas from the Frankenstein films and this sort of thing. And everything from that era was hazardous voltages, and it wasn't, I wouldn't want to call it special effects at that time, because it was real effects, you know, and all those films, all those arcs and things were really there in front of the actors and actresses. Everyone had to be aware of them.
Wow.
Have you ever knocked out power to your street?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm frequently blamed for any power outage that happens for any reason whatsoever. Yes, yes. It gets old after a while. I mean, you're 20 miles away. That rainstorm I had nothing to do with.
My dad worked for the power company for a long time, so I kind of know how that stuff works, and I can imagine you just, you know, popping a fuse on the street a few times, but yeah, sometimes it happens regardless.
Yeah. These days, it's interesting working with the electrical discharges, even the really low power ones, because they're charging everything in the room. So sometimes you turn off the machine, you walk up to something, and you know, you get a spark from whatever was slightly conductive in the room. And my cat is kind of getting annoyed when I do this stuff at the house, because he picks up on all of it. So I've moved the lab out of the kitchen, so he's not inconvenienced in any way walking around.
Yeah, I'd say in the age of cell phones, I can see a lot of that messing with the electronics we all carry with us.
It does, and fortunately, because I live in a kind of a historic neighborhood, most of the houses were they were built with a wooden lath with a kind of a screen mesh and stucco. So many of the homes act as Faraday cages. Yeah. And in the house that I lived in when you guys visited, it was right on the path to the airport. So the only reason I didn't get nailed by the FCC is because I was working inside of a Faraday cage, even though it wasn't originally designed as that. My museum acted as a Faraday cage automatically because of the house construction. Because I had taken coils outside, and I could turn on a machine out in my driveway, for example, and see the neighbors' lights in their dining room start turning on and off, wow. Even though they weren't home. So,
Jeff, one other thing I wanted to talk about. So you had mentioned to me that you've been doing some new work in UV, ultraviolet.
Yes.
Yeah, why don't we touch on that real quick?
So I had always wanted to work with lights, light bulbs. And because Tesla and Kinraid and even Geisler, Crookes, all of these inventors that were pioneers, they all worked with vacuums, with light, with electrical discharges in a more controlled environment. And I always wanted to make light bulbs, but I never had access to any of the equipment. And I had a friend recently, her dad was a neon artist, and Beck's her name, and she approached me, and she was like, "Jeff, you know, I have my dad's old neon shop. Would you be interested in it? Because, you know, it's, you know, very personal to our family, but we can't really keep up the business. It's kind of gone the way of LEDs and everything else now."
So did he just like make neon display signs? Is that what you're saying?
He did. Both of them did, actually. They would repair neons. They would make neon art. And it's something I want to do my whole life. And so I acquired this stuff, and I started making my own light bulbs, and I started replicating a lot of Tesla's light bulbs, like the wireless lights and single wire lights.
It's funny to me, because it sounds like it'd be right up your alley, right? Because a neon light is basically a tube with neon gas that with a current going through it that makes a plasma, and it glows, right? That's exactly the basic idea.
Exactly. And if you go back 100 years, you don't even need neon gas inside, just plain air at a vacuum lights up. So it was a gold mine for me to be able to research this. But the work I do, environmental work, just the UV lamp itself in its basic form hasn't changed much over the years. So the idea of being able to bring new things to the table as far as wavelengths of UV produced and using different gas mixtures, trying to get away from mercury, which is in every fluorescent light and UV light.
Now, what's the purpose of the UV light?
Primarily these days to kill bacteria.
Okay.
There's different uses. One's to kill bacteria and viruses. One's to keep surfaces clean, sterile, that sort of thing, like sterilizing instruments. But also, there's the company I work for is using the UV for catalytic reactions in the air to produce hydrogen peroxide in the air, for example, as a way of killing bacteria and viruses airborne.
It may be different maybe different wavelengths, but also it's used a lot as a curant. Like, for example, dentists use UV to cure some fillings, and even like nail polishes there's some UV curing there.
Yes,
you put them under UV lamp.
Yes, I recently bought a 3D printer. It's amazing what's happened in that whole realm. For $250, I got a UV cure resin 3D printer. And it's quite amazing actually now, because of the same technology I can remember 10 years ago being like 30, 40 grand to get one. And so, yeah, UV is a hot topic recently, and there's a lot of unexplored realms of the ultraviolet spectrum. And that's something that I was interested in for a while. Earlier on in the year, I've been collecting UV books just because I like the history of all topics relating to any of this kind of high energy physics radiation. And as it turned out, there was some books on Abe Books from the British astronomer Alfred Fowler, and they were from his personal collection, and they were on UV spectroscopy. And so I reached out to the seller, because I noticed that they were actually signed books, some of them. And he said, well, yeah, I worked with Fowler and I have the remains of his library. And I said, okay, I want all of it. And I spent a lot of money and I got all of these books. And it was amazing just the knowledge I wasn't aware of that people were doing. And one was, for example, vacuum UV. There were people like Victor Schumann, Theodore Lyman, Exner, Hasek, Ader, Valenta, Kaiser, Watts, all of these pioneers that were exploring what wavelengths of UV different metals would give off.
And for the folks at home, UV, as far as I know, is typically defined as and light within the wavelength range of 400 nanometers down to, I think, 10 nanometers is still considered UV. So
Yes. So of those wavelengths, very few of them have actually been explored. I mean, we know what the sun gives. So anything sort of 375, 400, 315, around that area is what we typically see from sunlight.
That gives you sunburn.
Yeah, and most UV bulbs, modern ones, are around 254 nanometers. So the lower wavelengths have been really not explored much. It's only recently with excimer lamps and different gas mixtures that we're able to explore some of the lower wavelengths. And then a lot of the wavelengths are absorbed in the air immediately as they're being generated. So the vacuum UV, that anything kind of around 120, 140, unless you're in hydrogen, you can't really study those effects. But there were a lot of pioneers working on that at the time and trying to explore on the... from my interest, it was, of course, from having COVID pop up and having this pandemic, trying to see the most efficient wavelengths for killing bacteria and viruses. So that there's theoretical curves of what which wavelengths kill viruses the quickest.
I'm fascinated by your use of the term explore. It seems kind of odd to me, and maybe this is the case, that we just haven't looked at all the electromagnetic radiation spectrum. But so you're just basically creating different spectrums of UV and seeing what happens to things in that particular spectrum of it, or?
Right, right. And part of that has been the lack of, I would say, a lack of innovation on the lamp side of things. You know, in the industry, you know, it's like much like fluorescent lighting. Not much has changed in fluorescent lighting over the last 50 years. Once in a while, someone will develop a new phosphor. It's a little bit brighter. It's a little bit yellower or whiter, whatever. But it's not like the technology's changed that much. In UV, it's the same issue. You have certain glasses which transmit UV, so that automatically limits what wavelengths you can experiment with.
Another really interesting point, and when I think of the electromagnetic spectrum, right, really broadly, so that includes like visible light, radio waves, microwaves, all these things, so many of them, they have distinct uses that have been very practical. But it's true, like what you said, Jeff, I'm not aware of too many uses for the UV, especially like the vacuum UV and below, just because it does get absorbed in air. So it hasn't really popped up commercially too much because it doesn't go anywhere. It always gets absorbed right away.
Exactly. And they were, what was interesting, some of the pioneers in like treating skin conditions, for example, there were physicians, Frederick Strong, Niels Finsen in Denmark was one. They noticed that even they were making lamps that you would press directly against the skin with special windows. And so some of the windows, like magnesium fluoride was one, they found you could transmit lower wavelengths of UV. And even though they would be absorbed in the air, if the window was pressed firmly against the skin, it would still be absorbed in the body. So they were still trying to experiment physiologically with some of these wavelengths, removing the air from the picture, basically. And it's, who knows? I mean, there a lot. It's like electrical discharge research. I mean, what can we do at the end of the day if we can replicate upper atmospheric lightning in the lab? I mean, is there a commercial aspect? Maybe not. But is there scientific aspect? For sure, because it's not like we can study at 50,000 feet up that easily.
And just the fact, like you pointed out, James, that there's regions of the spectrum that we can still explore. It's one of the great fallacies, which is that people tend to think we've already looked into all this stuff. That's not true. there's mystery still.
I remember when I started in college, you know, in the physics department, and all the physics we learn is Newtonian physics, and it's 400 years old, and there's nothing new. And then by the time you get to like junior, senior year of college, I remember there was an astrophysics professor, and we'd be in a lecture and we'd ask him a question. He'd look at us and be like, nobody knows. Like, this is, you finally get to the part where it's research where nobody knows what's going on. And it still blows my mind sometimes that, you know, light, it's around us. We know about it so much, but there's so much that just still is completely unknown.
There was the research was interesting. I mean, Niels Finsen, he won a Nobel Prize actually for working with light with lupus vulgaris, and he was treating a horribly disfiguring medical condition with just light waves, and he was filtering sunlight, and he was using carbon arc lamps at the time, and he found that various wavelengths could treat these conditions in the same way that smallpox patients would have these horrific lesions pop up and they found out if they shielded the room with red glass that they could prevent these lesions from appearing. And so there with UV, it gets interesting because there's evidence that certain wavelengths are less harmful to the human body. And that's something that's really interesting to explore, because you can think of, like, during this pandemic, you have, there's a limit to how you can use UV around people, obviously, yes, for the safety factor, but if there were safe wavelength ranges, it would open a lot of doors for people.
That's a really good
for
point.
A lot of doors for research, and x-rays are even the same way. I mean, there's wavelengths of x-rays that cause less skin damage than others. And
we just need to find the wavelengths that are not harmful for people, are harmful for viruses, and can transmit through the air.
Exactly.
That's a big goal.
So I kind of want to get into this a little more, because it's, you know, what's going on right now. But so you say you're actually doing research with UV that could affect the pandemic we're in right now?
I took a great interest in the pandemic because from the beginning, and it's really been frustrating this year because I remember when this first happened, there was I would write down every day the total number of cases worldwide and how many deaths and what the mortality rate was, just because I had an interest in this. And I had so many people telling me, you know, who cares? It's in China. You know, it's not our problem. And I'm thinking, no, that is our problem. You know, that's someone's, these people's grandparents over there dying of this. And I heard of, for example, of people traveling and then not being able to leave the country. And right. I mean, I have friends that travel internationally all the time. And I imagine, like, geez, can you imagine like them being stuck somewhere where they have the potential of dying of something? What would you do in that situation? Mm-hmm. Especially if you work with this kind of technology every day, you have the possibility of actually helping out with it. And ironically, I started experimenting with meteorites.
Oh, and with meteorites?
I had bought, and this goes back in time, you know, sometimes things happen in life and you just always remember them. And my first gig with a museum was in Manhattan with an author, Adam Parfrey. And he was an underground author from Los Angeles that he ran a company, Feral House Publishing. And he published books that no one else would ever dare touch publishing. And part of my gig was just to have 500,000 volts through my body. He wanted something showy and flashy for his new book. But while we were in Manhattan, he said, Jeff, I want to take you somewhere. And we went to this evolution store that was there. And they had necklaces and jewelry made out of meteorites. And it impacted me from this age of, I don't know, like 18 or 19 years old at the time. I was thinking, how cool would that be to have a, you know, to wear a piece of meteorite? And a few things came out in the news about them. And so I ended up acquiring Moniana Lusta slices, which is one of the oldest meteorites, and it's hit Finland around 1906. And so I've had these fragments on the shelf, and as I was exploring with these gas mixes and UV lamps, bulbs and electrode materials and this sort of thing, I said, well, I wonder what the meteorite would do, because at the time I have these books on from these pioneers on what's called the UV emission of solids. And they were actually using the ultraviolet spectrums from different metals to try and theorize what materials would be in meteorites and comets that didn't hit the Earth. Because they figured if we can study the spectrum of what's in space, we might be able to theorize what materials these things were made from. And thinking of that, I decided to do the opposite. I have meteorites. Let's put them in a tube, strike an arc between them, and see what spectrum of UV they produce. And as it happened, that theoretical curve of what kills viruses was hit 100% with the meteorite.
No way.
And so obviously we're not going to, you know, you can't start using meteorites inside of tubes, but I was able to, because of my interest in metals, I was able to alloy different metals at my house, basically in my kitchen. I was melting nickel and iron and iridium and indium and all these different metals, alloying them together and just studying the UV spectrum from a different perspective. In the past, they were studying pure elements as far as what wavelengths of UV they produced. And I started alloying materials and then refining the apparatus to where you can study the wavelengths the best. And that's something in the past, they kind of used whatever apparatus they had available to them at the time without giving the adjustability factor in there. And there's a lot of things that adjust that can affect which wavelengths of UV become prominent in these experiments. And it's based on how you adjust the apparatus and how you affect the electrical discharge inside these tubes.
Were you able to determine what the composition of the meteorite was to get that nice spectrum?
Yes, yes. The metal analysis on it is interesting. I mean, most meteorites are mainly nickel and iron, but there are some very interesting trace elements inside as well. And what I found in doing the research with the different elements is that by using that as a base and then adding a few extra elements here and there, you can really see how the spectrum's enhanced.
Have other people been doing this research, or was this just something you did in your house one day?
No, I mean, it's something out of the blue, because even it's a really obscure topic, and you know, there were people who dedicated their lives to the subject back in the early part of the century, but not much has happened since because of a part of it was because of the ease of the modern UV lamp, something pretty easy to produce and not that complicated, and a lot of people figure if it's not broke, why fix it, or why try to change it at all? But it's that kind of attitude that doesn't lead to progress at the end of the day. I mean, it's fun to start experimenting, and now there's LEDs are finally becoming practical in the UV spectrum, and I mean, there's a lot of them on the market right now, and most of them don't have nearly the power you would need to actually do anything useful. However, there are a few that are, and so with the LED side of the UV, we're able to produce very specific spectrums that weren't produced before. Mm-hmm. So that's opening new doors for research, and what I'm doing is just kind of an extension of that to try and open more doors yet. And also to resurrect some of the work of these pioneers from the past, because they were just a bunch of old guys with a spectroscope studying wavelengths. And, you know, now there's more elements to play with. When you start alloying them, the sky's the limit as far as what you're seeing.
So it sounds like your interest is one foot in the history and one foot in progress at the same time.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's so much, you know, in Tesla's time, he had written so many articles in journals, and he never really made things commercial. And there were so many young people at the turn of the century that just took one idea of Tesla's and took off with it. Mm. And these were the people that developed, you know, portable X-ray machines or radio transmitters or you name it, you know, any kind of novel light bulbs, that sort of thing. So many people took off with his inventions because he didn't develop anything commercially. And it was just the fact that he kind of threw that seed out there of that sparked people's interest. And there were so many inventions, so much progress being made at that time. If you ever see like an electrical dictionary from the 1880s, you can pick it up and it's, you know, the book might be 2 inches thick, and you look through it, all the batteries and lamps and coils and things. And then you pick up another electrical dictionary from 5 years later, and half of the stuff isn't in there because it never caught on. And it was, you know, there was so much technology at the time, so many advances, only a handful of it actually got employed into use. And so by going back in time, you can find these little inspirations and get ideas and of people who maybe scratched the surface, maybe they did more, but because they were maybe in the wrong place at the wrong time, the ideas never developed much.
You know, Jeff, in a generation, you know, including James and I, where we're so busy being kind of entertained by our devices that we don't spend nearly as much time in our free time just doing this type of interesting work. And I think that's one thing that a lot of people can learn from what you're doing as far as just being curious and tinkering with things. Is there any advice you could give to, you know, us younger generation who would look at the work that you're doing and say, wow, that's actually really, really helpful and good? What can we do? What's the advice?
There's a lot I learned. And one thing, I mentioned Tesla a lot, but he's a kind of a great figure to start because our lives are so influenced by the work he pioneered. So many people have tried to replicate his work unsuccessfully. And the few of us that have and had things that worked were just following things by the letter. And a lot of times it was just replicating work with the same materials he was using at that time. And I know it's easy, you know, in today's age to replicate an experiment of someone from 100 years ago. And you might start looking through it and say, well, why would I use that material? Because I have something better now. Or why would I use this when I have this? And what happens as a result of that, there's reasons these materials were used sometimes back then. And I can give a really good example of silk-covered wire. And many of these coils that I replicated over the years, I was using this silk or cotton-covered wire. And any modern electrical engineer will tell you that that wire is completely useless. The only thing that the silk is doing is a kind of mechanical covering because they didn't have anything else at the time. And the reality is I've replicated many of those coils with the best enameled wire we have today. And the coils would all burn out. And at the end of the day, it was just because of the winding techniques. There's so much tension on these coils. Even if you vacuum impregnate them with resin, there are still voids that you can't fill because of just the mechanics of this wire. When you have the silk covering, it acts as a wick. And when you vacuum impregnate a coil with silk covered wire, the silk acts as a candle wick and draws all of the insulation straight against the wire. So you have absolutely no air bubbles or pockets inside the burnout.
Interesting.
And it would seem absurd to use an archaic wire like that in anything modern, but there are things you can do. And even raw materials like why certain things behave the way they did. Well, you know, insulators were different back in the 1890s when you had ebonite, a form of hard rubber. I mean, it's different than using PVC or something from today. And so I would say that the start would be, if you're going to try and replicate something from the past, do it as authentically as you can before you come to a conclusion that it doesn't work, or you draw a conclusion that this doesn't work the way the person said it would.
In a similar vein, I don't know a whole lot about this, but I've heard from people that like so many of Tesla's stuff hasn't been recreated. And like, if I could be wrong on this, correct me, but I believe the largest Tesla coil ever made was made by Tesla himself. And why is it that none of this stuff has been recreated? Is it because it's a bad idea, or it's so hard to do, or it's just not economically feasible? Did they know more then than we do now? It's
Tesla is interesting. I mean, his life, it's pretty complicated. There is definitely evidence that he was going a bit senile in the end of his years. And so there was a lot of things that he published that wasn't made public, not because of any of these conspiracy theories that are a million and one out there, but because just because of his mental condition at the time as he was older. But much of his research, the few people that replicated things authentically, I did some. There were two physicists, James and Kenneth Coram, who also replicated his work very accurately. Everything that was done to the letter actually worked. And it's not to say that there weren't times that there were press releases just done for the media that were absurd in some ways. But the actual research, one, I can give you a good example with x-rays. Tesla published in 1898, he described a single electrode x-ray tube where he was operating a tube with just one wire, and he was pushing the voltage so high the tube was making, at that time, it would have been x-rays and gamma rays together. He was running the tube from over 500,000 volts. And he was describing this tube, the glass was getting so hot in this tube because the far glass wall of the tube was acting as one of the electrodes. And it would actually become incandescent. It would melt. It would become orange. The tube would soften, and he was describing something that sounded absurd. And he was saying that the tube would develop bubbles on the outside of the tube, and that you would see jets of gas escaping from the tube as the vacuum inside the tube became harder. And as the vacuum became harder in the tube, the x-rays were getting more and more powerful. And when you think of the physics of that, the first thing that comes to mind is, well, this is a very high vacuum. If you heated the glass at a point it would soften, it would implode in all likelihood. But I replicated the experiment a few times and witnessed the same thing. And it was partly because the electrical energy inside the tube was so intense that as this glass was softening, a plasma discharge was pushing on the glass from the inside and actually keeping the bulb in the shape it was. And these jets of gas were actually plasma discharges forming on the glass as it was the opposite electrode in this tube. Now, the minute you turned off the power, this tube would implode. But the whole time it was operating, the X-rays were getting more and more powerful. And I witnessed the exact same thing that Tesla was witnessing. And when he published it in 1898, actually the guy Rollins I mentioned before, who was a dentist, was saying, this is nonsense. It can't possibly be true. And no, it's just a matter of following things at a letter. And sometimes you see things that you wouldn't expect. And it's with this kind of research, it's about, and it's a hard thing to do, is not making assumptions. And sometimes you have to go into things thinking, okay, I just have to try this and not expect one result or the other and see what happens. And it's like the Kinraid research with the spark discharges. I didn't expect, I had experimented with hundreds of Tesla coils. I never saw any of these fractal forms in the air like I'm generating now. And it's just one formula that actually worked, and it works consistently, and I'm able to do it now. And if I didn't see it with my own eyes, I wouldn't believe it.
When you have that eureka moment of replicating this thing from the past that some people said was impossible, what do you do? Do you then go and like publish it? Or is it just on to the next thing? What's your general reaction?
It's normally a bit in disbelief at first. So it takes a while to just take it all in. But there's a real magic about it in a way, because when you realize that you're doing something that only a few people have ever witnessed in time, there's something amazing about it. And it just makes you want to work more. And it gets down to a lot of this research, and people have yelled at me. They say, you should sleep more, you should eat better, you should do this and that. I mean, for the last 20 years, I've lived on 2 to 3 hours of sleep a day for a good 20, 25 years. And I would say, today, like a lot of young people, they're very focused on healthy eating, on life balance and all this sort of thing. But there are very few innovators that actually live this way with the kind of recommended daily values of things in life. You know, sometimes to make progress, you have to, if you have the passion, you have to just see it through. And it doesn't mean live unhealthily necessarily, but it's, you know, if you're too lax with yourself, you don't get things accomplished sometimes.
I think that would be a good segue. So we're running short on time, but Jeff, one thing we like to ask is what gets you excited about the future, either for your own work or just for the world? And then similarly, what are you most concerned about moving forward?
Well, the most exciting thing for me is just the unknown and the fact that there are realms of either the electromagnetic spectrum, physics, electricity, anything that we don't quite know yet. And that's exciting. Because anytime you're exploring the unknown, you don't know what you're going to find. And so it's just this idea that there's opportunity possibly waiting. And it might not have anything to do with monetary success, just the fact that you could discover something that wasn't noticed before.
I say you haven't done, I don't think you've really done this for monetary success. You do it because it's
never.
Cool and interesting.
That's been the only reason all along. And it's, I think that's been why I still have fun doing it. when you start trying to monetize things, it's easy to get frustrated. And I don't know. I've always preferred to kind of take the route of let's not look for money in the end. And if something comes along, okay, it does. But if not, who cares? Let's keep experimenting, keep trying.
Like we were saying, there's still things left to explore. A lot of things.
There are. And as far as biggest fears for now, I would say actually with the pandemic, I noticed that, you know, even in the manufacturing industry, basic components have dried up during this pandemic. like simple components like fans that you could buy 100,000 of pre-COVID. Now you're struggling to find, and it's because we've outsourced so many things. And the biggest fear I have now is that, and being a machinist for 25 years, I saw all of the old masters die and no one fill their shoes. And everyone assumes, well, now there's CNC machines, there's computers, we don't have to know this knowledge. And I've seen whole industries kind of disappear from the country, and it'd be nice to see them return again, because we rely a lot on imports right now. As just every product we buy in the store is imported for the most part. And it'd be nice to actually get a lot of the knowledge back. I mean, knowing what happened during the Industrial Revolution, I mean, we were a leading country around the world as far as all of the medical equipment, scientific stuff. I mean, we made some of the best instruments that were ever made here in the States. And there were a lot of pioneers here. And just to bring back that spirit again and get people to interested in making things and knowing how things work. And some of these fields like glass blowing and tool and die making, foundry work, metal casting. I mean, they're dying arts.
Do you have hope that it could come back? I feel like for me, you know, I work in engineering. I've noticed a lot of my friends take up hobbies along these lines, but I'm not really plugged into how, you know, the general population, not just engineers, are how they're taking to that. But yeah, I got the impression that it wasn't too much. People tend to shy away from that work these days.
No, definitely. And it's great if in the engineering community, more people take an interest. And I noticed in the last few years, I'm excited that I've seen more women get into engineering now, which I'm thrilled about, because I've had the rare experience of meeting some women machinists, and they were, it was just great to have women in fields they weren't in previously. And I think there's a lot they can offer to the table, because, you know, men and women think differently sometimes, and it's great not to have any industry polarized with one or the other.
Definitely. I would also say we still have a lot more work to do on that front, but we're going in the right direction.
No, definitely. Definitely. And I would joke sometimes. I would give lectures to different schools, and sometimes the beautician schools and the aesthetic schools that were mainly female students, they were asking a lot of better questions than some of the men engineers that were coming to the museum.
Interesting.
And it was because they were using this technology every day, and they were just curious how it worked. And so I think the advice for young people is to never assume you know it all, and to always ask questions and always try to find inspiration. And, you know, the world's a fascinating place. There's so much unexplored science and history out there. Even with the history, some of the silly quackery history, I mean, it's funny stories. It's things you don't think about. It puts your mind on a path it wouldn't be otherwise. So I think the idea is never to, never become complacent in what you do or think you know it all, and just keep an open mind to things. And, you know, one of my favorite books is, one of my favorite books on physics is called, Natural Magic by John Baptista de la Porta. And it was a book written in the 1500s, where it was a very dangerous time to write about science. So the way they got around it was kind of disguise, kind of add religion to the spectrum somehow. So they called it Natural Magic. And in the book, there was a lot of absolutely absurd things like black magic and this sort of thing. But then there were a lot of really practical things like preserving fruit on the vines, coloring metal, tempering metals, making explosives, using optics like magic lanterns, that sort of thing. There were a lot of physics involved. So, and to think at that time period, you know, 1500s, there's a book you can open and read and laugh at every other page. And then there are other pages that you look at and say, oh, wow, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that. You know, here in winter, you can preserve fruit on a tree in the middle of winter and have it ripen by doing this to the fruit. And I mean, just new perspective on things. And sometimes it's, you know, just to understand the mindset of back then is pretty fun and fascinating.
I can't help but wonder all this, you know, a lot of what you've been talking about, and like the ripening the fruit on the vine is really cool stuff and, you know, practical stuff, but the world still doesn't know about it. And
no, exactly.
Why?
I mean, I think it's just, you know, when I was doing electrical research, I was always under the impression that everything was developed in the 1800s, kind of late 1800s, early 1900s. And I got a book by Joseph Priestley, who was an amazing philosopher. He was like the Google of the 1700s. And he wrote a book called A History and Present State of Electricity in 1777. It was a three-volume set of books that are about 3 inches thick. And I got these books, and I'm reading through them. And there's just experiment after experiment that was done from the early 1700s. And here there was a guy, Francis Hauksbee, who he's not only making electrical machines in 1705, he was making electric lamps by experimenting with new inventions at the time, the pneumatic pump, vacuum pump. He was putting mercury in a glass container, sucking all the air out of it, and noticing when you spin it and rub your hand against it, the friction would make light, enough that you could read a book next to you. So here's a man creating an electric machine that to generate light in 1705, 1706, 1707, around this time period. Who would have known? I mean, that's not something we really learned about in school. And so, yeah, there's a lot of fun history and experiments that were done by people that were out in the middle of nowhere doing this stuff. They did document it, but so much was being documented at the time, we just don't hear about it.
And, you know, James, just to add my take on your question, I think a lot of people, maybe the sad truth is a lot of people don't need to know these things. You know, you can get by, and, you know, we live in 2020 and there's so many things. But at the same time, we would be better served to know these things. And just thinking about it now, you know, that's one thing that we could help with, you know, even just having a podcast like this, where we might bring some of these ideas to light. Maybe now someone will get inspired. I hope, if you're listening out there, to go look up some of these things that Jeff noted that maybe you haven't heard before. Because I do really think just as people don't need to know these things to survive. And they're
right.
People are living busy lives.
My lights work. My phone works. My computer works. You know.
Yep. Things are so easy for us now. Just flip the switch. James, you got any more questions before the most important question?
I don't have any right off. No, I'm good.
Well, Jeff, if that's the case, I'll ask you the most important question. I don't know if you've seen the show. Jeff, what is your favorite pizza topping?
Oh, that's a tough one. But bacon is always a favorite.
Really?
Like bacon. But also hot sauce. I love sriracha. I love harissa. It's a new hot pepper blend from Tunisia. I've learned about, and yeah, I like spicy things.
Do you just put the hot sauce on top of the normal pizza, or do you replace the tomato sauce with the hot sauce?
No, that's a really good idea, though.
This is innovation.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, I like anything with bacon. And recently, I had my 44th birthday, and we made a whole roast pig, and we made it a flying pig with bacon wings. we drank Viking style through these animal horns. We were drinking mead and absinthe, and yeah, it was brilliant.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, that's enough bacon for a couple slices.
Yeah, definitely 47 pounds.
Wow.
Oh my goodness.
But yes, sriracha replacing the sauce on pizza sounds brilliant. I think that's
the innovation Jeff's going to be doing this week.
There you go.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Follow your curiosity. Well, that's usually one of the last questions we like to ask. Let me do this now also, Jeff, just for the listeners, if anyone, you know, just heard
heard you talk and is interested and maybe wants to follow you, what are some ways that they can do that?
Well, the easiest way, if you're in West Palm Beach, is to look for the absinthe bar Patank. I'm normally there in the evenings. However, if for more international friendly ways, I have a website, Electrotherapy Museum. Kind of a historical website I've had for years, but some of the research is on there. I've stayed off of social media the last year. I might return in the future, but there's way too many politics for my liking right now.
That's a true statement. Great. Well, we'll put a link to the website in the show notes again, because we like to give the fans an opportunity to follow up if possible. And Jeff, any further comments while we're here?
Well, no, I thank you guys so much for having me on. And if anyone's interested in any of the research I'm doing, I'll post some pictures too of some of the, like, these fractal discharges in the air are quite beautiful.
That was one thing we talked about before the show is for those of you who are only listening and have never seen Jeff's things in person, the best way to experience this is to actually see it, either video or in person. So audio, there's a little difficulty there, but we'll try posting some pictures or links just so you can get an idea of and put some visualization to some of what we talked about.
Yeah, I had some. It was so hard to photograph this stuff, and I have a local photographer, Gato, I'm going to be working with to try and capture some of these. There was a girl experimenting in Philadelphia, Kelly, and Frank Jones, my old partner in crime, collecting stuff. We all tried to document some of the stuff as best as we could, but only now the cameras are getting to the point where they can capture a lot of these low light electrical discharges. So there's lots to come in the near future on that topic.
Fantastic. Maybe someday we'll have you on again in the future. I think that would be really great. But thank you for giving us an hour and a half of your time.
No, thank you so much. Great to see you guys again. And
This was a lot of fun for us. So.
Great to talk technical things for a bit.
Absolutely. It's what we do.
All right. Thank you, guys.